questions or comments for a little bit. And then I'm going to offer a little talk about the way the center runs. And a little sit, and then the managers will close with some announcements. And so as far as the theme goes, and sometimes there's themes to different retreats, but to me this is a, I guess we'd call it a theme, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Retreat. I mentioned this at the beginning of the retreat that the Buddha considered the foundations of mindfulness the most direct way to experience awakening. The foundation of the body, the foundation of feeling tones, the foundation of mind states, and the fourth foundation called the dharmas. And just maybe a little bit more about these four foundations that we've been practicing. In the first foundation of the body, there actually is six different practices, and we really practiced most deeply in the first three, which is mindfulness of the posture, the breath. We also open to other bodily objects, such as the sounds or sensations, and bringing our mindfulness and clear comprehension into our day-to-day activities, all these ways of living in our day-to-day life with mindfulness. And just as a point of reference, though we didn't go into these other practices, but they're found in the foundation of the body, and occasionally we offer retreats on these particular practices. And one is an anatomical practice called the 32 Parts of the Body Meditation. The fifth is a practice of the four primary elements that exist within all material phenomena of solids, liquids, motion, temperature. And the sixth practice is a very graphic contemplation on the mindfulness of death from a body when it dies on the first day until gradually through different stages of decomposition ends into dust. And a very powerful practice. Again, there's an old Hindu proverb that says, everyone thinks everyone else is going to die, but not me. And this particular practice offers a correction. And the second foundation, as mentioned, feeling tones, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The third foundation of mind states, being mindful of different patterns, being aware of different thoughts and emotions. Within these first three foundations, I also had mentioned this as well, is that there's many, many times where within these instructions of the first, second, and third foundations, it's pointing to the origination and the dissolution of each object. In other words, pointing to the impermanent nature of things. The fourth foundation of mindfulness has a few different terms and definitions, and I like to consider them more as a collection of wisdom teachings. And actually, most of the Dharma talks in this retreat were drawn from the fourth foundation. There was a talk about the hindrances, factors of awakening. We were being mindful of sense spaces and actually what's called the aggregates, which is it's these teachings of non-self. And Don, of course, gave a beautiful teaching on the marks of existence. It included that. And then there's a teaching of the Four Noble Truths that also was offered. And it really feels to me that the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is complete in itself. There's actually a wonderful story about this. In Burma, there was a teacher named Mingum Sero, and this was in the probably early 1900s, late 1800s or so, and he was a scholar monk and had mastered and very learned with the teachings of the Dharma, But he had this sense that he didn't understand it from his own direct experience. And so he went on this journey all over Burma, trying to find someone that actually had an experience, like enlightenment, and what are the best practices. And eventually he was told about this hermit monk that lived in this cave near Mandalay in the Sagaing in the hills. And so the story goes, he went there and he met this monk, and he asked him, like, you know, please tell me, what are the teachings? And the monk evidently said, the teachings are right here, right in the four foundations of mindfulness. These are the teachings. And then taught him in a deep experiential way these practices. And Mingham Seto became realized himself. And then two of his very famous students, Mahasi Seto and Tampulu Seto, really brought these, this kind of like a revival of Vipassana meditation that swept through Burma, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and so forth. And many of the Western teachers were students, particularly of Mahasi Seto and some of Tampulu Seto. So just a little bit of a background here. But if anything, this is, in my opinion, a very traditional Satipatthana, Vipassana, mindfulness meditation retreat drawn on these four foundations of mindfulness. And, you know, these are practices that we can keep for our lives. And certainly as the retreat continues on till it ends, we continue practicing the body, the feeling tones, the mind states, bring your mindfulness into day-to-day activities. And even when we leave here, these practices continue on. I mentioned earlier about that the real retreat is our life, and what comes up in our life is our practice. And so, wherever you go, here you are, as they say. So that's just to give you a little bit of an overview. If I had to go to a desert island and I was asked to only bring one book, it would be the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. That's it. And in a nutshell, but there's, of course, many. The canonical literature is huge. But anyways, I'm going to pause here before I start riffing more, and who knows where I'll go. Pass it on to Don. You want to just comment on that or add?
I think you covered it beautifully, but I'll add a couple words anyway. As Bob was saying, we've been taking a tour through the Four Foundations of Mindfulness this past week, and he mentioned the one book he would take to the desert island and the vast corpus, the library that is the Pali Canon, the texts that we draw on in this tradition. And I just want to make a plug for having your primary text in these unfolding hours be your body, your experience, this direct moment followed by the next direct moment. The Buddha said everything we need to learn to awaken is in this fathom-long body. So to really trust your experience, stay with your experience. The container changes. It's already changing, you've noticed. And this is such a rich time, a very rich time to watch how the process of shifting back towards daily life, mentally, physically, intersects with the solitude, the stillness, the time and practice and informal meditation. So don't miss it by skipping ahead too fast, or skip ahead too fast and come back and notice what that felt like. Right? We all do it. It's not a crime. So the four foundations of mindfulness are each a lived experience. Even that fourth foundation related to is the teachings, they come alive in us. Whether they be hindrances or awakening factors or the noble truths, they live inside of us. This is a living tradition, a practice tradition. So find your relationship with it in these coming hours, days, moments of your life. Thank you.
I'll just add one other thing that Achan Chah, the wonderful Thai forest master, said that one day someone asked him and was begging him, what book can I read? What book can I read? Tell me the book on the Dharma. What book can I read? And he just looked at this person and said, this book. This is the book here. Yeah. Ehi Pasiko, which means see for yourself with your own direct experience. But then offered one other, I feel like a jewel of an offering. Someone also asked the Buddha, besides seeing for yourself through your own experience, like, what path do I follow? What's a good path? And the Buddha responded, any path, didn't say my path, but said any path that lessens greed and hatred and ignorance, or its opposite, grows contentment, love, clarity, wisdom. This is a good practice to go. So that's like the hand on the rudder. Like, may our hand be on the rudder as we are here and as we leave into the world, the lessening of greed, hatred, and ignorance, the increasing of contentment, love, and wisdom. Yeah. So shall we open to some questions and or comments? And we have like about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll...
Do we have someone willing to run the mic? I see multiple volunteers hopping up. Thank you, Tina.
You didn't meet Tina last night, but Tina was helping to replace the service leader, so we just want to thank you. Matt was here the other day, but just thank you for your support. Any comments? And Tina can bring over the mic. And if you don't want a mic, you can speak a little loud and we'll say it back. This one over here. Please, Sharon.
Thank you. Yes, you hear me? I was wondering if one of you could talk at all about the tendency, at least for yogis, at least for me, to think I'm doing the practice right when it feels good and doing it wrong when it feels bad, because that's sort of an aha I had, which never really, penny never really dropped. I'm not sure it's dropped, but it's in there somewhere now. And yeah, I was just wondering if you could give your take on that to support our practice. Thank you.
I'm happy to offer a preliminary thought or two, and then Bob, if you want to fill in. What comes up immediately for me is the wisdom teaching. That's really helpful to just drop in whenever. It's especially true when things aren't going well, but it's also true when things are going well, which is that from the perspective of mindful awareness, any object, any experience is equally valid. It doesn't matter to awareness if it's pleasant or unpleasant. It doesn't matter for the purpose of mindfulness what is unfolding, as long as it's able to be held in mindfulness. So that's my initial thought, Bob. I think you may have some others.
Yeah. Thanks for the question. Good one. When the practice becomes kind of like trying to have a goal, it's a setup for sure suffering. And, through the years, I've learned in many ways to not try to get anything, not try to go anywhere, and to take what comes, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And there's always learning to be had, the clinging or the aversion, and to embrace that and to investigate that. But I love the notion that, and, you know, it's an aspiration, the one that develops greatest stability in the midst of it all, understands so deeply that everything changes. There's pleasant moments, there's unpleasant moments, and there's ups and there's downs, and perhaps this greater sense of understanding of that, so that, you know, to be with what's here, because whenever we're resisting that, there's suffering. And yeah, so when there's anger, let there be anger. When there's sadness, letting there be sadness. When there's confusion, letting there be confusion. When there's delight, let there be delight. But it's our grasping on or pushing away that exacerbates. And yeah.
It's definitely, beating yourself up is definitely in the aversion category. Definitely. It would be interesting to consider for yourself what's being pushed away. What is being pushed away? It's a kind of a form of violence to the self, and it usually is some part of us trying to keep us safe. So to also notice the beneficial, not beneficial, but the seeds of whatever goodness is underneath it, and try to relate to that. What's really not been helpful in my own experience is the aversion to the aversion. That's trying to push something away, and as far as I can tell, all it does is pump it up. Easier said than done not to do it. But again, to step back into the awareness, if possible, and trust that if it's seen without adding to it, that's one way it can unwind. There are many ways. Bob, would you like to add?
All right. Yeah, that was nice. And, you know, again, I can't speak enough about it as our stories and our conditioning and, like, what's fueling and driving this thing that I'm being hard on myself. And again, like, what type of beliefs are there that I believe to be so true, that I'm not made of the right meditative stuff? I'm not this, I'm not that. That critic has worked overtime for too long. And so to really, you know, I'm interested in what is the root of that belief that keeps on repeating itself over and over again. And as that's perhaps more and more understood, it begins to release us from the hostage of being kept in that belief. But it's so deeply embedded and so deeply rooted. Yeah. Yeah, it's all conditioning. Please.
If it is okay.
Yeah, yeah. I was contemplating about imposter syndrome is the term that many like to call it. and that coming up a lot in my practice. And if, like, there's the recognition that it's coming from, like, an anxiety response, like a control, like, you know. But on the flip side, it also can be kind of a space for one, like, a growth mindset, like, wanting to improve, like, recognizing you're not perfect and you can be better, coming from a place of, like, I'm not good enough, then I can be better, right? But I guess my question around that for you all is, if in your own experiences with mindfulness and that, if you've experienced imposter syndrome in your life, if you have anything to say, or like if it gets any better with age. I think I'm the youngest one in the room, but so, yeah, I don't know if that's kind of my question.
Yes, I've felt imposter syndrome many times. And again, here's this story, this belief, who am I to do this? And there's actually a beautiful story of the Buddha's awakening, another story, where the Buddha's beginning to awaken and this celestial being called Mara, who was like kind of like an enemy of the Buddha and did not want him to wake up. And so this beautiful story of Mara creates like 100,000 soldiers with bow and arrows, and they're all pulling him back, and then the Buddha's just sitting there. And then all of these arrows are just heading towards the Buddha to kill him. And the Buddha opens up his eyes and says, "I see you, Mara. I see you, fear." And in that moment of the seeing, the arrows turn into flower blossoms. And then the Mara said, "Who are you to say you're the Buddha? Who the heck are you? Say that." So the Buddha put his hand down, right, like that. That's the mudra. That's the symbol. And he put the hand down, and the angel of the earth, so again, these beautiful cosmologies came up, and the angel says, I see he's the Buddha. I witness this. But this is for our own journey to awaken and to begin more and more to see through this belief that I am an imposter. Maybe it's not true. And as my old teacher, Bishop Siako, said, "Bob, I already can see you. You're fully enlightened. You just don't know it. That's why you're so stupid." So I'll say, "You're fully enlightened." And maybe we'll get to know that someday, or believe that actually that somewhere inside is that truth. And to see through the imposter, to see through this voice that just tears us apart day in and day out. And maybe what it's calling for, it needs just so much love and care. And kindness. You've been hurt. I see you now.
Sometimes it's worth considering that the real imposter might be the inner criticism, covering up a beauty and a strength and a maturity that we're not yet ready to take in. So I just beg you to hold that possibility for yourself. Everyone. And everyone else. All of you.
Except for me, because I'm a
Even you, Bob. So I think that was the last one. We're going to shift to a little appreciation for IRC. And I'll start with a brief story. So I spent some time ordained in Burma almost 15 years ago now. I can't believe it's been that long. And for those of you who haven't been to Asia, it's incredibly touching. The outpouring of generosity from the monastery to the community and from the community to the monasteries is really quite a sight to see. The monastery I was staying at, the monks and nuns, and at the time I was a nun, so I would accompany now and then, would go on what was called pindaput, to gather food, begging bowls, about that size, roughly. And so much food would come out of these tiny little huts, these poor little houses, that there had to be several lay people with wheelbarrows behind us. It was quite something, just mountains of food. And I was there long enough, I was there some months, to see the full cycle play itself out, because I don't remember if it was once a lunar month or once a quarter, but the monastery would host something called Rice and Oil Days. And villagers from miles around would walk and stand in line and receive staples, as much or more food than any of them had given, back from the monastery. And it just went on like that. It was just this like cycles of generosity. And of course, the biggest generosity of all was the Buddha's teachings flowing out from the monastery, from the sayados. And I was feel particularly fortunate in this monastery. This sayado gave away a big chunk of land to the nuns in one corner, and then gave away another big chunk of land to the first free medical clinic in Yangon in another corner, staffed all by volunteers. So it was just, it was a teaching on so many levels. The place, the spirit, the engagement, it was just beautiful. And so some years later, I was part of the IMC community when this place came to be. And just like I felt in the monastery, the first time I walked in here, it wasn't even finished yet. There's this experience of walking into generosity, walking on generosity. Everything in this place is given, donated, offered freely out of love, gratitude, kindness. Every little detail, the handmade cabinets, the Buddha rupas, the food, the garden so lovingly designed. Armies of volunteers support this place. In this cycle of generosity, of giving and receiving, everything you see here was procured by a volunteer, or cleaned by a volunteer, or thought of by a volunteer. And then there's the generosity of these successive waves now, over a decade, of practitioners coming through IRC. This building was seasoned with metta practice before it even opened, and it's been seasoned with meditation every few weeks ever since. So I really think of this place as being a physical instantiation of love, care, generosity, of people having given out of joy and faith in the practice. That it just keeps going. It's kind of miraculous that it just keeps going based on that faith and that practice and that love. So I know I speak for both Bob and I when I say it's just incredibly moving to teach here, to be in a field of this much openness and care, generosity, gratitude, love. So thank you very much for bringing your part to it. And look out, we wouldn't have a retreat if each of you hadn't shown up. You hadn't practiced. Some of you have practiced here many times. Many of you have been volunteers here. Thank you for what you bring. It's really touching. So deep bows. Bob, do you want to add anything? Okay. I think we're going to sit for a few minutes. So sit in the field of this place.